From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Most of the time when people talk about Mormonism and race, they're thinking of the way Latter-day Saints have treated people of color over the years, like denying black people the priesthood. What you don't hear a lot about is how early Mormons were seen as racially different by Americans of that time. It's part of what interested the Utah historian Paul Reeve. In his new book, Reeve says Americans were looking for ways to justify the discrimination of Mormons, and so they defined them as an in-between people, not really non-white, but not fully white, at least not in the way they saw things. Reeve says Mormons responded with these aspirations toward whiteness, which they achieved just as the country was headed in a different direction. Reeve is joining us today to talk about his book called Religion of a Different Color, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By the early 1900s, Mormons were ready to be seen as part of American culture. They had isolated themselves in the Intermountain West and tried to live apart from the world for a time. But at the turn of the last century, they were finished with that and had started looking for access to political and economic power. In his new book, the historian Paul Reeve says this was a period of transition where Mormon leaders were shifting away from polygamy to monogamy, from communalism to capitalism, from isolation to integration. And a critical part of this transition was to convince the rest of the United States that they were, wait for it, white. Which seems ridiculous if you think about the makeup of Mormonism at the time. I mean, almost all of these people were very white, mostly Nordic and Anglo-Saxon, and most in those early days were born in the United States. But outsiders saw it differently. They put Mormons into groups of other marginalized Americans, and they saw them as physically and racially different. Mormons responded with what Reeve calls an aspiration for whiteness. And as you now know, they achieved it. They were able to assimilate into American society, and they came to be seen as legitimately white. But then the country headed in a different direction. Today in the program, Paul Reeve is joining us to talk about the Mormon struggle for whiteness, which he says is a microcosm of the history of race in America. The book is called Religion of a Different Color, and we invite you to join the conversation if you have comments or questions, your own observations. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. His full name is W. Paul Reeve. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Utah. He's the author of a number of books, including Making Space on the Western Frontier and Between Pulpit and Pew. And he's joining us here in the studio. And Professor Reeve, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dad. Pleasure to be here.
I guess I wanted to start with, and we should jump in with this image, which is really on the cover of the book. It's a cartoon. This is from 1904, and it appeared in Life magazine. Now, before you explain it, set up the context for us. What's going on? This was 1904. What's happening in the context of the time in America?
Well, when this political cartoon appears, Joseph F. Smith has just returned from a withering 6 days on a U.S. Senate committee. Reed Smoot, who's a sitting LDS apostle, has been elected to the United States Senate by the Utah legislature, but the Senate is trying to decide if they will allow him to retain his Senate seat.
Yeah, the U.S. Senate.
The U.S. Senate, yeah.
What do we do with this? Is this right? Should this be proper, I guess?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So all kinds of charges of lingering polygamy, Mormon continued involvement in politics. Has the Mormon Church really Americanized? Can we really trust that they've done what they've said they would do, that is give up polygamy, that is keep their hands off political affairs in Utah? And so when you have a sitting LDS apostle elected to the United States Senate, the Senate is still skeptical.
Yeah.
And so they put not only read Smoot on trial, but the entire LDS church on trial. And they subpoena a variety of high-level LDS officials, including the president of the Mormon church.
That's kind of remarkable.
It is. It really is remarkable. I mean, it's its own Mormon moment that most present-day Latter-day Saints have forgotten about. But the entire LDS church was basically put on trial for a 3-year period while the Senate decides whether it will allow Reed Smoot to retain his Senate seat.
Now, in the end, they let him, and he sticked around for 30-plus years as a senator. So that works. But as before they resolve the question, there's debate and there's conversation, and this political cartoon appears in Life magazine, 1904. Give us the image.
Yes. So the image is simply titled Mormon Elderberry Out with His 6-Year-Olds Who Take After Their Mothers. And I think it's no stretch of the imagination to suggest that Mormon Elderberry, the old bearded man in the center of the image, is really a caricature of Joseph F. Smith.
Yeah.
And his beard became popular fodder in the press at the time, especially after he testifies before the United States Senate. And he's holding a string
that he fits the caricature of what most people sort of thought of as these weird Mormons in the West.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And he's holding a string of children. And 6 of them are white, but one is Asian, one is Native American, one is African American. And the implication is that then Elderberry has wives who
are all kinds of races.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And put that in context, that would have been kind of seen as not legitimate, as kind of outrageous.
Well, it would have been illegal. Right. So at least 2 of these marriages would have been illegal in Utah, as well as the vast majority of states across the nation. And so really the suggestion here is that Mormon polygamy is not just destroying the traditional family. It's destroying the white race. If you understand how much Americans fear race mixing in the 19th century, they're projecting their fears of race mixing onto the Mormons. And this appears in 1904. I think it is this moment of transition wherein Mormons are attempting to claim a white and racially pure future for themselves at the same time that the nation is attempting to trap them in this racially suspect past. And so I see this political cartoon as a parting shot that really demonstrates the nature of the way in which Mormons were racialized in the 19th century. And I use it as an organizational tool for the book. So Joseph F. Smith returns from Washington, D.C., and on the 6th of April, 1904, issues what historians refer to as a second manifesto. He says,
explain what the first manifesto was. And I think most people understand this story. But basically, the first manifesto is we're not practicing polygamy anymore.
That's right. That's right. So there's a 14-year period of ambiguity. So the first manifesto is 1890. The Supreme Court has opened up the possibility that the federal government could start confiscating LDS temple properties.
Right.
And that's the last straw for the Mormon hierarchy. So they abandoned polygamy to preserve temple worship. But there were a variety of post-manifesto plural marriages. Even members of the hierarchy entered into post-manifesto plural marriages. And these accusations are brought to light during the Reed Smoot Senate hearing.
Yeah.
And Joseph F. Smith returns from Washington, D.C., realizes the nature of the pressure that the nation is bringing to bear. And he says on the 6th of April, 1904, in an LDS General Conference setting, we really mean it this time. We really are giving up polygamy.
Yeah.
And it's called the Second Manifesto. And he puts teeth into the First Manifesto, in essence, by simply saying if anyone takes a future plural wife, they are subject to excommunication. And that's the policy that the LDS Church practices from 1904 to the present.
Let me ask you, one of the things you point out a little bit later in the book is that scholars are often interested in race and Mormonism, but they're usually interested in the way Mormons deal with Native Americans, for example, which we'll get to, and blacks, for example, which we'll get to as well. But you don't often see this conversation, that is how Mormons themselves were racialized in American society. When did you first start paying attention to this issue? When did you first notice it as an issue? Because I dare say most people don't recognize that this was an issue, really, it seems.
No, that's right. I mean, the subtitle of the book is Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness, and I've been working on it for the past 7 years and received a lot of really skeptical looks when I tell people the subtitle. Mormons are just white. What do they have to struggle for?
Right.
And, you know, I started coming across evidence in some of the historical writings I was doing in research for my first book, people sort of just suggesting that Mormons were racially or physically different. And I thought it was curious, and so I started to keep a file. And then I came across, you know, a 1860 Senate report filed by a medical doctor, which suggested that polygamy in the Great Basin was giving rise to a new race. And I thought, you know, there's something going on here. And then I read a variety of whiteness studies, which is this field in American history that suggests that those who are immigrating from Europe, especially Irish and Italian immigrants, were not fully accepted as white and that they had to go through this process where they earn whiteness for themselves. And I said, you know, this is happening to Mormons, but the difference is this is an inside religious group. It's sort of the quintessential American religion, and yet converting to Mormonism somehow makes a person racially suspect.
Yeah.
And you know, I situated then the Mormon experience within this broader context of whiteness studies. The whiteness studies have largely been about labor and immigration, and I'm saying there's also this religious component that whiteness studies scholars have neglected for the most part.
How did we used to talk about race? Because this is one of the things you point out. You quote this historian, David Roediger. Did I pronounce that right?
Roediger.
Roediger,
yes.
David Roediger, right. Uh-huh. who said this, and you quote him in the book, that in the United States a century ago, people did not talk about the race the way we do now. Explain that, because what you say is that race was really thought of as a loosely used term. It was more, as you put it, a socially invented category than anything else.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so for this to make sense, you have to divorce yourself from 21st century notions of race and try to recapture a very illogical and fluid racial context that operated in the 19th century. So race operated as nationality. So Irish immigrants were racialized as not white. And Mormonism was born into a moment wherein monolithic whiteness was fracturing in the United States. And so all kinds of groups were all of a sudden racially
illegitimate,
suspect.
Was this immigration? Because you say, the Mormon experience, in fact, wasn't necessarily about immigration in the sense that most Mormons, early Mormons, they were native born.
Right. It gets mixed in with immigration, and so it's one way in which native-born Americans try to distinguish themselves from immigrant groups or undesirable immigrant groups, such as the Irish or Italian immigrants. But I'm also suggesting then that they're doing the same thing to the Mormons. Mormonism is born into this racial context, and how do you justify discriminatory policies against a group that looks like you? Yeah. Well, one way you do so in the 19th century is to suggest that they're not like you. And it's not just that they're religiously different. It's that they're racially different. And so you have to divorce yourself from the notion that Mormon whiteness is an assumed fact and take it as a contested variable for the story to make sense. And I'm suggesting trying to introduce a new paradigm within which to understand the Mormon racial story. So as you pointed out, most scholars who have looked at Mormonism and race have looked at the ways in which Mormons themselves denigrated other groups as racially suspect, such as Native Americans or African Americans. But I am simply arguing that you can't understand that story without first understanding the way in which Mormons themselves were racialized, and it becomes a struggle over whiteness in this process.
You know, one kind of modern parallel that I did see, and I wondered if you had thought about this, and I'm sure it's happened in other places, but the genocide in Rwanda, where they the Hutus and the Tutsis, they have distinguishing characteristics of their surely, but one thing that I think happened in order to sort of make it easier for that genocide to play out is that they demonized them, even though they looked very, very similar. And that was one thing I thought maybe that is a kind of an interesting context if people are having a difficult time making a connection for that, because Mormons looked white. So how do we demonize them and make them so they're not really white?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you start to assign to them a variety of undesirable character traits. Yeah. And so you have to understand also that race equals undesirable character traits. And the notion was that those undesirable character traits are biological and inborn.
Yeah.
And so for African Americans, for example, they're lazy. Look, we have to whip them to get them to work. Or they're ignorant. They're not well educated, denying the fact that slavery didn't give them a chance at education and uplift. But they started to do the same type of thing to Mormons. So the first label from the outside for Mormons is Mormonite. And it starts to accumulate a set of undesirable characteristics. They're ignorant. They're dupes. They're superstitious. And especially after polygamy becomes widely known, they're highly sexed. And it just sort of takes on a life of its own. And you assign those undesirable characteristics as if they are inborn within this group, and it's a way in which you are racializing them as not completely white. They're less than white.
Yeah.
It's never to the degree of the same hard racism experienced by Native Americans or African Americans, but nonetheless in between people.
It's interesting. There's this one moment you write about in the book where people were describing Mormons as having a melancholic look to them, like looking for a way, like they were probably looking at someone whose ancestors came from Norway and trying to decide how they didn't fit in the American scheme of things. And so they looked melancholy. They looked dumb, I guess, too, right? I
mean, sure.
Was that the kind of characteristic they were trying to assign them?
Yes. So it's a degraded Mormon body. And you have to understand sort of the development theory that operated in the 19th century. Those who looked at societies argued that all societies go through three major stages, from savagery to barbarism and barbarism to civilization. And as all societies progress along this trajectory, they abandon despotic rule as well as polygamy. And here you have supposedly white people in the Mormons who have given their will over to the despot Joseph Smith or Brigham Young and started to practice polygamy. These are the two things that mark civilization's decay backwards along that trajectory.
The twin relics of barbarism?
Exactly. So the twin relics of barbarism were polygamy and slavery.
Yeah.
Right. And understanding that development theory helps to understand that 1856 Republican Party platform. That's exactly how people saw it. We have white people who should know better. So they must not be fully white because they are leading to civilization's decay. And really what's at stake is American democracy. You have to understand how whiteness was privileged in the 19th century and, well, obviously still today. But in any case, the first Congress, 1790, says to be a citizen, you have to be free and white. And John C. Calhoun on the floor of the United States Senate in 1848 says democracy is the government of a white race.
You also write about these racial schemes that in fact had always been a part, though, of the American experience. But with Calhoun and in that era, they really set themselves in cement, this idea that we are a white an American race / white race.
Yeah, that's right. Whiteness is seen as normative.
Yeah, yeah.
It's what is normal and it's what is required to be a citizen of the United States. And if you are less white, you can't practice self-determination. You can't govern yourself. And Calhoun makes this argument that, well, let's look around the globe. There are no white societies that practice democracy. Therefore, his illogical conclusion is they're incapable of practicing democracy, and only white people are capable of it. And so, you know, what they're doing to Mormons is suggesting that they're incapable of self-rule, and you situate Utah's long struggle for statehood within that context. That's very much a part of what's taking place. They're incapable of governing themselves. People who practice polygamy are more akin to Asian or African societies. And the Supreme Court actually makes that point in the 1879 Reynolds decision.
We're going to come back to that because I found that part fascinating, the connections that outsiders were making between Islam and Mormonism.
Absolutely.
In the 19th century. Talk a little bit about this hierarchy of race a little bit more, if you would, though. Mormons were seen as in between, but they also conflated them with other marginalized groups. And so they were seen as red, as black, as yellow. It was kind of a hierarchy there.
That's exactly right. So what operates in the 19th century is this hierarchy of whiteness. So as you have this fracturing of monolithic whiteness, racial thinkers are attempting to then situate groups on this hierarchy and to decide where they fit. And Anglo-Saxons really
They're at the top.
They're at the top.
Yeah.
And no one can really quite decide where to place Mormons, but nonetheless, they are knocked several rungs down the racial ladder. So had they not converted to Mormonism, had a person not converted to Mormonism, they would have been seen as Anglo-Saxons at the top of the racial ladder. But the mere conversion
turns them Native American in some cases, right?
In some cases, they're more red than white, yeah, or more savage than the savages. In some cases,
did they believe some kind of physical transformation happened upon their conversion in some way?
You know, it's never
never quite spelled out.
It's never fully to the point that there's a physical transformation, but you know, there are ways in which they suggest that Mormons are guilty by association. So they're almost from the beginning conspiring with Indians against true white Americans. And any time Mormons are driven out of any location, I found evidence that that was one accusation leveled against them, that they are conspiring with Native Americans against true white Americans. And the rumors just run rampant. They have thousands of Native Americans at their behest waiting to slay white America, and therefore we need to drive them from their homes. And it takes place in Jackson County. It takes place in Clay County. It takes place when Mormons are driven from the state of Missouri altogether.
Is this where the idea of Mormons having horns came from?
Mormons with horns is mixed into all of this, right? It's one way in which they are denigrated as racially aberrant, that Mormons have horns. It's a degraded body. They're more demonic than they are, you know, acceptable white people. It's just one suggestion of many in of the ways in which outsiders suggest that their body is physically different.
One of the things you say is that Mormons really, as they got better at pushing back on this idea, that the sort of the ironic thing that happens is they create their own racial identity, which we'll really dig into as we go along. But give me the broad sense of what that means. They evolve from seeing everyone alike unto God, which is a scriptural reference that comes from the Book of Mormon, which you reference in the book, to not so much to seeing Mormonism as being white for a time anyway.
Sure. So, you know, the big picture is simply that in the early decades of Mormonism, there's very much a universal gospel message that's seen as available and should be carried to Africa and India and the globe, in fact.
And this is Joseph Smith's innovation.
Absolutely. And the first black convert to Mormonism is 1830 in Kirtland, Ohio. And
amazing for the time if you think about it, right?
Right. And within a few months of this black convert, I found newspapers in Philadelphia and New York. Mormons have a black man worshiping with them. And this is not a celebration of Mormon diversity. This is an accusation, right, that they are accepting people who should be segregated in the 19th century. They're welcoming to all people. They walk out with colored women is one of the accusations leveled against missionaries in the South. These charges are leveled against Mormons in the first couple of decades. And, you know, there are a couple of black men who are ordained to the LDS priesthood. There is open priesthood and open temple, universal male priesthood, universal temple admission in the first couple of decades of Mormonism. And that starts to give way across the course of the 19th century and fits and starts. And I argue it's basically out of this effort at claiming whiteness for themselves on the inside. One way you do so in the 19th century is in distance from blackness. And unfortunately, Mormonism then distances itself from its own black converts.
In a very crucial way. And in a way you really peg to 1852. We'll come back to that as well. I want to spend some more time with that. Paul Reeve is with us. His book is Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, University of Utah professor Paul Reeve is joining us to talk about the story of the Mormon struggle for whiteness. Which seems strange because Mormons in the early days were pretty much all white, but it's a very complicated story. His new book is called Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's talk about Native Americans. The conceit for the book is that you take each child and build a chapter around them, give or take, more or less anyway. And of course, one of the children that in this political cartoon from 1904, that this Elder Barry, clever, is holding hands of a Native American child. So let's talk about that part, because you say that those who persecuted Mormons in the early years really blurred those distinctions between Mormons and Native Americans. And what's so interesting about this part of the story is, of course, Mormons have this affinity with Native Americans. And for those who don't understand, Native Americans really fit crucially into this Book of Mormon story. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think, you know, the Book of Mormon obviously articulates for the Mormons a way of viewing Native Americans as fallen descendants of ancient Israel in need of redemption. And so they have a theological vision of who the Native Americans are. And really the first organized proselyting mission is to the Native Americans for the Mormons. And, you know, it's based upon this notion that they will redeem fallen Israel and that the Native Americans will join with the Mormons in building a new Jerusalem on American soil. And so they're for Mormon converts, for white Mormon converts, it's a thrilling kind of vision of who Native Americans are. For outsiders looking in, however, it leads to all kinds of accusations that really Mormons are trying to conspire with Indians against true white America. The same year that Mormonism is founded, 1830, the United States Congress passes the Indian Removal Act. So Native Americans from the East are being removed across the Mississippi to Indian territory. So these are people in the broader American mind who should be segregated and removed.
Because they're savage and rebellious and all of those things.
Right. And, you know, the first couple of administrations, Washington, for example, had suggested that there is this possibility for civilization and uplift. But by the time Andrew Jackson becomes president, he's convinced that it's just not going to work. And the best thing to do is to remove them from white civilization so that basically white people can claim the land for themselves. And so he is very much a supporter of the Indian Removal Act, which is playing out at the same time that Mormonism is founded. And Mormons come along with this different idea of who Native Americans are. And it leads to all kinds of accusations that, in fact, they are becoming like the savages, becoming more savage than the savages. And also it leads to episodes in which broader America uses Indian removal as a metaphor for understanding the Mormon experience. And so some people in Missouri start to talk about Clay County as a Mormon reservation.
And because Mormonism, like Native Americans, pose a threat to American autonomy or whatever it would be.
That's exactly right. And how do you solve the Mormon problem? Well, maybe we use the Indian solution. And they explicitly
will say that.
Yeah. Right. So extermination is one method, but reservations is another method. In Hancock County, Illinois, after Joseph Smith's murder, you have a local official who explicitly proposes a Mormon reservation and calls it a Mormon reserve. And he articulates it as patterned after an Indian reservation.
It's interesting you say outsiders thought that even if Mormons were white at their conversion, and we talked a little bit about this before, but becoming Mormon would mark a deterioration toward redness.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So even in the way that they act or their association with Native Americans, it's this sort of notion of guilt by association. If you are associating with them, you must be more like them than you are white. So sometimes the accusations are that, you know, they're dressing like Indians, especially after they arrive in the West. They're dressing like Indians and killing people on the Overland Trail. That's a notion that predates the Mountain Meadows Massacre by at least 7 years.
Although the Mountain Meadows Massacre really cemented this idea in the minds of a lot of Americans.
Absolutely. So the massacre just reifies what has been said about Mormons up to that point. See, we knew it all along and here's our proof. They actually did it. Right. But those charges, those accusations appear in even dime novels in picture form before the massacre, 2 years before the massacre. And the earliest I found was 7 years before the massacre, the charge that Mormons are dressing as Indians and killing people on the Overland Trail.
Wow. It's interesting talk about the fact that there was this affinity. And you write about how, in fact, Mormon leaders were, in fact, encouraging Mormon men to marry Native American women. But also, and this is the kind of the interesting irony, I guess, and, the Book of Mormon also confirms this old Christian idea that skin color was a curse. So how does that fit in the story?
Mormons understood that in the 19th century as applicable to Native Americans. And the interesting thing, you have two curses then at play. The curse in the Book of Mormon was only applied to Native Americans. And even the internal narrative in the Book of Mormon suggests that those who are cursed can overcome this. So it's more cultural than it is racial. And Mormons see that as their obligation. In founding this new religious kingdom, their obligation is to reach out to Native Americans and help redeem them from that curse. And one way Brigham Young suggests that Mormon missionaries should do so, especially missionaries to Native Americans, is to marry Native American wives. And so especially in Utah territory, he explicitly says one way in which you make Native Americans white and delightsome, to borrow the Book of Mormon phrase, is to marry them. And so it's a part of racial uplift coming from the Mormons from the inside. Outsiders who look at those same marriages argue that it's racial denigration. Mormons are marrying Native Americans and denigrating the white race into savagery. And so it's a contest over the outcome of those marriages. That's a part of that struggle for whiteness. So the outsider suggesting it's creating savage and degraded offspring, and Mormons suggesting it's created elevated and racially superior offspring.
Let's talk about the black experience in Mormonism, which you referred to in the early days, 1830, black man is becomes Mormon. Somewhere along the line in those early days, two black men, at least that we know of, are actually ordained to the Mormon priesthood, access to endowment ceremonies, the temple. They have access to all of that in those days. But then something happens. And I'm not sure exactly what it was. Again, you peg it. You peg at least it's they're transitioning away from this throughout those early days. But in 1852, you write, Brigham Young really cements the relationship with Mormons and blacks to the up until 1978, basically. And he gives these three speeches. Talk about this part.
Sure. So just one point of clarification. So black men were allowed the Washington anointing ceremony in Kirtland. No evidence that they were allowed an endowment. That takes place in Nauvoo, and Elijah Abel wasn't in Nauvoo when that's introduced, and so we don't know what would have happened. But he does appeal for his endowment once he arrives in Utah territory. And it is in Utah territory in 1852. Brigham Young gives three speeches to the territorial legislature. And it's the first open articulation by a Mormon prophet president of a racial priesthood restriction. Yeah. And it's as the territorial legislature is contemplating a bill designed to govern the relationship between the black slaves and their white masters who have arrived in Utah territory. These are converts to Mormonism. Some of the slaves themselves are converts to Mormonism. The white masters are obviously converts from the South who have brought their slaves to Utah territory. And that territorial legislative session has to decide what to do, what laws will govern this relationship.
Right.
And so it's really the universalism of the early decades of Mormonism that they are inviting all people. That includes slaveholders and black slaves, freed blacks. They're inviting all people into this Mormon gospel fold. Other religious groups in the 19th century experienced either being split or schisms. So the Methodists and the Baptists split altogether over these same questions. Mormons hang together in those first couple of decades by simply saying, we allow everyone in. But once they arrive in the Great Basin, Brigham Young is going to then order that diverse group of people, white over black and free over bound. And he makes his views
abundantly clear.
Yes, exactly right.
Because he said, you actually quote him as saying, I'm a firm believer in slavery.
Sure. He says that I'm a firm believer in slavery, but then he goes on to sort of complicate what he means by that. right?
It's not the same slavery as in the South, he says.
Exactly. And he uses it in some ways in this speech sort of metaphorically. We're all slaves to sin, right? And he goes off on that as well. But, you know, he certainly makes it perfectly clear his feelings of black inferiority in 1852, which is, I think, important to note, different from his feelings in 1847. So Brigham Young is on record in 1847 as favorably aware of Q. Walker Lewis's priesthood, and Q. Walker Lewis is a black priesthood holder. And so to say that Brigham Young is just innately racist, right, you have to account for the fact that in 1847 he says, we don't care about the skin color. We don't care about color. Color doesn't matter to us. But by 1852, it certainly matters.
Why?
To Brigham Young.
What gives? Because he's trying to get Mormons assimilated, getting them – yeah, why? I wouldn't even suggest it. What changed?
Well, there are a couple of cases of interracial marriage that he deals with in 1847, and it seems to be sort of an erosion of his sort of open and universal notions that start to give way. And then you also have –
So that assaults his sensibilities?
Like absolutely.
It's okay in theory, but actually – and I'm seeing – if once he starts to actually see it, it doesn't seem so good anymore.
Well, and it's also a part of, you know, the broader American context. Yeah. The majority of states in the nation have laws against black-white marriage, and those who are thinking about interracial mixture are talking about the offspring of interracial mixture as being incapable of producing offspring themselves. And Brigham Young seems to buy into those 19th century notions about the consequences of race mixing. And when he applies it to priesthood, if you mix race, then the offspring will be ineligible for the priesthood. And you're creating this whole group of people then who can't function in church leadership capacity. Is one of his fears. And so in 1852, to the territorial legislature, as they're contemplating this racial priest this servant code, Brigham Young also lays out his rationale for a priesthood restriction. He basically says they're also debating an election bill. Who will be able to vote in Utah Territory? And remarkably, Orson Pratt
pushes back.
We uncovered some new speeches from this legislative session that had never been transcribed. And Orson Pratt and Brigham Young had experience as butting heads before this, and certainly at the 52 legislative session, they butt heads again. And Orson Pratt speaks out vociferously against the servant code that's being contemplated. He argues that curses are not multi-generational, that God may very well curse one generation, but it doesn't pass down through. And he's sort of, you know, latching on to the Mormon notion of agency. Joseph Smith.
Well, that's what's so interesting about it, because as you point out, agency is a fundamental tenet of Mormonism. And you say that Brigham Young was setting his own agenda on blacks, and he even departed from this important foundational principle of agency, at least because Joseph Smith said that, look, all people are judged not in original sin, not for Adam's transgression, as he put it, but for their own sins. And the Book of Mormon says all are alike unto God. So you have all these basic foundational principles that should be equality. But Brigham Young departs from that.
That's exactly right. And he only resorts to the curse of Cain in the Bible. He never resorts to any other Mormon scripture, only the Bible and the curse of Cain. He never argues that blacks were less valiant or neutral in the war in heaven, another Mormon theological idea that comes to later justify and explain the priesthood restriction. Brigham Young never resorts to that. His only rationale is Cain killed Abel, and God put a curse on Cain. He understood it in the same way that the broader Judeo-Christian tradition understood it for, you know, 1,000 years before Mormonism was founded. And because Cain killed Abel, God cursed him with a dark skin, and Cain tried to usurp Abel's position in this great chain of being. And as a result, Cain and his descendants, which Brigham Young said were black people, will be excluded from that great chain of being altogether. And you have this debate over the servant code and the debate over the election code, and Orson Pratt is suggesting that black men should be able to vote. And Brigham Young says in his speech on the 5th of February, they won't rule over me in Utah Territory. and they won't rule over me in the church. And so he's talking about, we're not going to let them vote and participate in the election process, and we're not going to allow them to have priesthood positions within Mormonism so that white men would have the ability to lead a congregation or rule over a white person. So he's certainly asserting then that white over black and bound over free in his hierarchy that he creates out of the 1852 territorial legislative session.
There's probably no question of who is going to win that debate between Orson Pratt and Brigham Young.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But it really is remarkable that Pratt is so forward-thinking in 1852. I mean, this is well ahead of the rest of the nation in terms of black suffrage. And he votes against two municipal bills, Cedar City and Fillmore. He votes against them because he says it doesn't allow black men – those municipal bills don't allow black men to vote. It's really quite remarkable that Orson Pratt is on record and willing to stand up against Brigham Young in 1852. But you're absolutely right. Brigham Young certainly wins out on that count and starts this racial priesthood restriction that dominates Mormonism for the next 130 years.
Paul Reeve is with us. His new book is Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Professor Paul Reeve. We're talking about his new book, Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness. So another one of these questions you deal with is that the way that so-called Mormon problem was juxtaposed with the Chinese problem, and more broadly, how Mormonism comes to be conflated with just Asians in a very broad sweeping brush. And this is so interesting that outsiders conflated Mormons with Asians in the sense that they compared Mormons with Muslims. Joseph Smith was called American Muhammad. Talk a little bit about this, because what was the connection? I mean, seen as lustful, that was one thing. These ideas of harems, that was part of the connection that they were making between Mormons and Muslims, I guess.
Sure. So some of the comparisons were religious, and historians have looked at this aspect before, but I was most interested in the ways in which it sort of bleeds over into the racialization. And so, Muslims are inherently violent. It's the Quran or the sword. It's convert or be killed. And the accusations leveled against the Mormons are similar on that count. That's one nature of the comparison. You know, Joseph Smith produces a new book of scripture. Muhammad produces a new book of scripture. Muhammad is described as a religious fraud, Joseph Smith as a religious fraud. So in a variety of ways, there are religious comparisons.
Here's another way, and 'cause I have to get this in. The idea that Salt Lake City or Mormon communities looked like Middle Eastern communities.
That's exactly right.
I don't get that at all, but what was that about?
It's one way in which 19th century outsiders looked in at the Mormons and suggested we have really an Oriental problem on our hands. We have white people who have deteriorated into Oriental despotism. What do Oriental people do? They give their will over to a despot. So Brigham Young, Joseph Smith, described as tyrants and sultanates run amok in America, and therefore—
And all credulous, just the believing whatever the despot told them.
That's right. And then they live in harems. And so they just play up this notion of the hedonism and the sexual excess that they perceive is bound up in Mormon polygamy, and describe even Mormon villages and the Mormon community in the West as more Oriental than it is American. So in a variety of ways, it's one way of trying to situate and mark Mormons as less than white.
And also not capable of democracy.
Absolutely. And in the process of making these arguments, the suggestion is, and the argument, the explicit argument is that marriage is racial and monogamy is the preserve of the white race. And polygamy is therefore less than white. It's more Asian or African than it is white. And this is something that the Supreme Court buys into in its 1879 Reynolds decision.
You also write, Parley P. Pratt said he found Islam to be preferable to Catholicism, which probably didn't help.
No, it didn't. It didn't. And in fact, you know, in Nauvoo, the religious freedom bill passed in Nauvoo actually says that Muslims are welcome in Nauvoo it's the only non-Christian religion that's listed in their religious freedom bill. And it's simply a pretty remarkable statement. There aren't a lot of Muslims in America at that point, but they're simply saying, we believe in religious freedom, and it lists a variety of Christian denominations, but includes Islam in its definition of religious freedom in Nauvoo. And so, yeah, that also sort of opens up the charge that Mormons are, you know, too friendly to Islam. Uh-huh.
So let's head back to the earliest 20th century now. Mormons are, as you put it in the book, clamoring for acceptance and respectability, and they get a boost from Theodore Roosevelt, of all people. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but in those days, President Roosevelt is really worried about this idea of racial suicide. And the Mormon question comes into play here. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. So President Roosevelt is concerned that white and acceptable Americans are not having enough children. And he argues that this will eventually lead to race suicide. So undesirable immigrant groups who are coming from Southern and Eastern Europe with darker skins and suspect religions immigrating to America during this time period and outproducing old native stock Americans in Roosevelt's mind. And he gives several speeches where he's fearful of race suicide. And all of a sudden, this coordinates with Reed Smoot's trial. Yeah. And all of a sudden, Mormons have an answer, right? And so all the white children that Mormons are producing become desirable in this process. And there are news accounts where, you know, there's no race suicide in Utah. They're actually doing their part to produce the white race.
Yeah. And they're seen as legitimately white sort of at that point.
Right. It's a transition moment. And
yes.
So you're still having a lot of the same suspicions leveled against them from the 19th century. But you also see then the transition taking place towards whiteness and acceptability. They're passing as white, in other words. They've abandoned polygamy. They've made pretenses of abandoning political control in Utah. And those are sort of the markers that had denigrated them as less than white in the 19th century. And so they're doing what the nation said was required to claim whiteness for themselves. And they're distancing themselves from their own blacks. The priesthood and temple restrictions are firmly cemented in place in 1908.
You quote what seems like a kind of disturbing speech by Mormon apostle Mark Peterson in 1954. It's extraordinary in its kind of racial hostility. He speaks about what the Negro is after, as he puts it. The Negro – here's your quote from Peterson. The Negro seeks absorption with the white race. He will not be satisfied until he achieves it by intermarriage. This is 1954. I mean, civil rights is starting to ramp up in the country. And then you've got Mormon apostles, leaders, talking about the fear of race mixing.
That's exactly right. And it's bound up once again with preserving white priesthood because Peterson is just going back to Brigham Young's argument that if we mix the races, then the production of the offspring from those mixed race marriages will produce children incapable of holding the priesthood, and you know the church is in ruin. In his projection, it really is a stunning speech that he gives at BYU. Remember, it's following Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, and it's one example of a Mormon leader who is digging his heels in at the same time, you know, Mormons have arrived at whiteness, and now once the 50s is another transition moment wherein the nation starts to go towards civil rights and Mormon leaders start to dig in their heels. And Peterson is basically arguing that segregation is divine and ordained by God.
So in the 1960s, the civil rights movement is really in place, and publicly the church says it supports civil rights in principle, but of course denies access to its temples and its priesthood for black people. And the church issues this statement that says black people should have constitutional rights, but that, quote, the priesthood restriction as a religious matter has no bearing on matters of civil rights. Now, here's the question, and I hope you don't think this is too much of a stretch, but I did wonder if you saw any connection to what was going on racially then and what's happening with LGBT rights today, in the sense that the church is issuing these statements saying, hey, we're on board with this anti-discrimination measure. We're on board with the idea that gay people have rights, have civil rights, but don't push us to accept them in our religious life. Do you see a connection there? Or am I making too much of that?
Yeah, some people point to parallels between the priesthood experience and LGBT experiences taking place currently. And I think there are some parallels. I also think there are some differences.
Yeah.
And, you know, the major difference is a gay person can be a Mormon and have a temple recommend.
As long as they're not sexually active.
Exactly, right? So adhering to those standards of conduct, a black person could not have a temple recommend no matter how worthy they were.
Right.
They were just barred because they were black, and there was no other religious group or no other group in Mormon history that that has really happened to. And the other major difference is that you have a historical precedent of black priesthood holders in the you know, black case or the racial case for the LGBT community. They have opened up temple admission, obviously not for gay marriages in Mormon temples. So there's a difference there. But the rhetoric, at least from LDS leaders, is that all those blessings will be available even if it is in the afterlife. I know that's not satisfactory for the LGBT community, but the comparison to blacks is different because they were just simply told they're outside the bounds of the ordinances required for full salvation within Mormonism.
We're out of time, essentially, but I do want to bring this round full circle to the I Am a Mormon campaign, which marks another – seems another transition. It's Mormons saying, look, we're as diverse as it gets, which is kind of remarkable too, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. So the major arc of the book is simply that in the 19th century, Mormons were denigrated as not white enough. By the 21st century, as too white. In the 19th century, they tried to claim whiteness for themselves. By the 21st century, trying to claim a more racially and internationally diverse identity for Mormonism.
Paul Reeve, his book is Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Daniel Lombardi. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.